Welcome to the Compose Like a Girl podcast. I'm your founder, host, and composer, Jocelyn Hagen. My Compose Like a Girl initiative amplifies female-identifying composers, helps conductors diversify their concerts, and works toward more equality in music programming and commissioning. I've been sitting down for conversations with some amazing composers, and I want to invite you into these deeper explorations of art and life. I hope you leave with some inspiration, just as I did. On today's episode, I'm sharing a recent conversation I had with Rena Esmail. I appreciate Rena's distinct musical voice and the way she discovered it by digging into her ancestry. Learning to trust oneself in finding that voice is key to every artist's journey. And once we find it, how do we articulate that truth to others? There is discomfort in pushing our own boundaries and the boundaries of others, but it is necessary in order to arrive at a destination that honestly speaks to who we are. Rena does a wonderful job at modeling this for the rest of us. She also has an incredible YouTube channel that features performances, interviews, and two seasons of her video blog called Resonant Space, created especially for emerging composers and creatives. Rena says that this blog is her tiny contribution to supporting and honoring the creative process. Check it out. If you want to hear the full interview, become a supporter by joining our Compose Like a Girl initiative on Patreon. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy. Greetings, Rena. It is so wonderful to have you here today for this conversation about composition and being a female composer, and well, and just actually being just a composer in general, which of course we all are.
Yeah.
There's a lot to dig into today, and I'm really excited to hear your thoughts on a bunch of these things. But I want to start with just kind of an open-ended question about your undergraduate experience at Juilliard.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, Juilliard was, it was a tough time. You know, I think you go into a place like Juilliard thinking you're going to Hogwarts, right? And you're just thinking, oh, I'm going to go there and I'm just going to have this great time. And one of the things that is, I didn't quite realize is that, you know, everyone who goes to Juilliard is the best standout, brightest young musician where they are. And then they all go to Juilliard and then suddenly they're all the people who used to be the best in their own hometown coming to be with one another. And it's really terrifying, right? Especially as an 18-year-old where you just have not experienced that level of talent. And I think the school is actually very different now, and there's a lot less, I don't know, there's a lot more camaraderie, at least between the composition students. But at my time, it really wasn't like that. It was, at least my experience, was just one where I always kind of felt like I didn't measure up. I wasn't really sure, you know, what I needed to do to feel like I belonged there. And I don't know. I'm glad to feel like the school has changed so much. But yeah, it was really a tough time for me at that age.
You know, I've heard you speak a little bit about that before, and I think I was very intrigued because my experience was very similar, but at a smaller scale. You know, I'm from small town North Dakota.
Wow.
You know, 7,000 people. And so going to St. Olaf, yeah, where all these really talented people were, I felt very kind of out of place and unsure of myself. How do you think that affected you in your first writing there, in your first compositions there at Juilliard?
Well, I think what's kind of interesting about my trajectory in general is if you look at my work from high school and then you look at my work kind of post-Juilliard, and especially once I kind of got into my master's degree and stuff, you can pretty much see a clear trajectory of like this kid who was 16, 17 years old sounds like the kid who's 25, who's 30, who's 35, you know. But if you look at those years at Juilliard, it's actually completely different writing. It's unrecognizable. And you can kind of see that two ways. You can see it in the way where I felt really intimidated and felt like I had to do something that wasn't natural to me. But on the other hand, I also think it was a way for me to explore different styles and really try things on and see if they fit. And maybe ultimately deciding that they didn't, and I wanted to go back to the kind of writing I had been doing before. But I do think I learned a lot by really trying on something for size that ultimately maybe didn't fit me. I mean, that's kind of something that I use in my life going forward, is that if I have something that I'm fighting, whether it's some kind of ideology, musical, you know, just something, some values in the world, I always do try them on for size to see where they might fit or what I might learn from putting myself in that opposite position. So certainly I think it taught me a lot, but it took me a while to realize that that's what I had learned from the experience.
Thanks so much for sharing all of that experience. So now you're teaching composers. Do you have a philosophy for how you approach teaching composition?
The thing that I try to do is actually comes from my teacher, Aaron Kernis, who I studied with at Yale. He, and actually even, you know, Susan Batti, who I studied with before I went to Yale, she was teaching at MSM and I was just taking lessons with her when I was teaching at the pre-college there. And they both do this thing where they will just, you know, kind of look at your music and ask you questions. And to me, that is a way to really expose what is a person going for and are they achieving that thing? Because I don't necessarily think, like, you know, I also studied with Sam Adler. And what was interesting about Sam Adler was that he had a sense of like, this is the right note, this is the wrong note. This note is wrong, it should be this, you know? And that, just for whatever reason, it wasn't my style. It didn't really work for me, even though I know like many, many people, it's really worked for them. And so the thing I love about Aaron is that he would do this thing where, you know, he's just this quiet, kind of very introverted person. And he would take your score and he'd kind of look it over. And then there'd be like a number of minutes of very uncomfortable silence. And then he would ask you like one question, like, have you considered this one thing? And you are like, oh my gosh, no, I have not considered that. And it's opening, it's blowing my mind, you know? And so he was just so good at asking these questions that, you know, if say I had considered it and I had, you know, something to push back on, he was open to hearing that. But if I hadn't considered it, it was something that maybe I should look at. And, you know, it was interesting because there were so many times where Aaron and I would have it out with each other. And he would say things and I would say, well, you know, if you're seeing this through the lens of Western classical music, it is X. If you're seeing it through the lens of Indian classical music, which is of course the other side of my practice, you know, it might be a Y. And so what was amazing is that Aaron was also willing to learn from me if he didn't know something. And that, I think, that exchange is just incredibly beautiful and is a way that both teachers and students can learn from one another. And it's something that I really try to implement with the students that I choose to work with and that I build relationships with, is that we're having this exchange because they're, especially now I'm 40, my students are often from a different generation. They're in their teens or in their 20s, and they have access to a whole world that I don't. And so I'm really curious to ask them questions because sometimes those questions will illuminate something for them, but often those questions will illuminate something for me. And I ask things that I'm really genuinely curious about, and we both learn at the end of the day. And I try to work with students who I feel are open to that process as well.
Oh, I just love that. That's a beautiful way of thinking about it. And it's also, it's helping them find their own voice or figuring out what they want to say.
Yes, exactly. And it's helping me figure out what they want to say too, because I mean, teaching composing is like mind reading. You have to figure out what it is that someone wants to say and then figure out how to help them figure out how to say it, you know? And there's right. So many times where you just want to be like, just do this, but you have you have to be like, okay, well, what do you think this should be? And get them to a point where their mind can develop a solution, because often the solution they come up with is not the solution you would have come up with, but you can really, really learn something if you're able to just move them just close enough so they can find their own truth.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. Well, and it segues pretty beautifully into this big conversation that I want to talk to you about, because I've been thinking about this a lot, where true artistry really lives, you know, where the great art happens. And I've been thinking that it's the intersection of actually three different things. The first being craft, the second being ingenuity, inventiveness, and the third being deep questioning and trying to answer some of those difficult questions. Do you find any truth in that?
Yes. And I'm so glad we're having this discussion, because no one talks about this. We have so many podcasts in classical music and No one is talking about, like, how do we get into the depth of what it means to make art as an artist? And, you know, we all sit there at the piano or at our, you know, singing or whatever, however it is that we make music. And when we talk about things, we tend to talk about things that are so much more tangible, and things where we're so used to talking about things in grant language of, like, what's going to make people outside of artists appreciate the art. And sometimes we tend to just believe that that is what art making is, and it's not. You're right. It is about having a really high degree of craft and being able to figure out how to get the ideas that are in our head into some tangible form that can be communicated to at least the people that are performing our music. This sense of ingenuity, yeah, which, where does that come from? I'm not entirely sure, but maybe just from a broader, you know, you take in things in the world and you try to take in as broad influence as you can. And maybe that's where the curiosity piece comes in, right? It's like, you can't always know where inspiration is going to come from. And it's not a one-to-one thing. You know, even in my music, it's like, when I started working between Indian and Western classical music, it was like, oh, let me take this one thing from this culture and this other thing from this other culture and kind of mush it together and see what happens. And that was super fun. But now I'm in this place where the inspiration, some things have synthesized. Sometimes inspiration is coming from the most random places. Like, I'm reading a book right now called Debt, the First 5,000 Years. And you'd think that why on earth would a book like that give me creative inspiration? But oh my goodness, I can't tell you the level of inspiration I get from engaging with this person's writings about the history of the idea of debt. So yeah, you never know.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I love that. And I also think that teachers of composition, you know, we're all just people and we all have our own strengths and weaknesses, right? And so some teachers are very good at teaching the craft, and some teachers are very good. I feel like when you talked about Aaron Kernis, about the deep questioning, you know, helping you find what that is. Yeah. And then ingenuity, how do you help someone find that?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, it's almost a feeling, and that I think we don't talk enough about how to be in our bodies. Like, you know, there was a point where I realized that, you know, that moment where you realize that you should say no to a thing, and you don't necessarily realize in your head. But for me, what happens is that it feels like my brain is trying to pull towards the thing and my body is pulling away from it. And so I get this weird thing where it's a physical sensation of my brain is trying to grasp a thing and my body's like, no, 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 abort mission, abort mission. And so I started to kind of recognize that as, oh, this is a thing. And that means that I probably have some reservations about it that I'm not allowing myself to see. And I think as composers, we tend to live in our heads so much that it's really hard to read our body's signals after a certain amount of time, unless you have some kind of, you know, really amazing physical practice that you do as well. And so, I mean, I do think that that is, ingenuity is maybe like that, or having that creative spark is like that, where there's a moment where you can kind of see, you're working on all these ideas and you can see, ooh, this could be a thing. And then you move in that direction. And that is a kind of a physical sensation that you have. I think sometimes you can have those thoughts in relation to a physical practice that you, it would never even occur to you if you weren't doing that physical practice. So yeah, over the years I've done many different things. Right now it's mostly just walking very long distances with this dog, and then hiking a little bit when I can, because I live in a really beautiful part of Los Angeles. It's in the mountains.
Oh, lovely. Do you meditate as well?
I do. So this is a really interesting. I'm glad you asked this question. As you can probably tell by the speed of how I talk, it's really tough for me to quiet my mind down. And so I tried for many, many years. I knew that a meditation practice would be the best thing for me. And I also realized that sometimes the things that you know you need the most are the things you feel the least capable of achieving. And so I tried many times to have a meditation practice and failed and failed and failed. And somehow, I don't know what happened, but I think my brain just finally slowed down and just felt, I don't know, safe enough, or felt like it was at a point where this year I could start a meditation practice. And I felt, it's really interesting, because I felt it in ways that you wouldn't expect. Like, I don't necessarily know that I'm calmer as a person, but I feel like I can feel a little bit of buffer between me and the world. my nose isn't right up against the glass. I have like a little bit of leeway to have a thought before I respond, or that I can just take a moment to see that I'm not right in the situation. I can just go a little bit outside of my body and almost see it from a third person's angle. And I think that has helped me so immensely, both with my music and in just understanding where I meet the world. Because I think as a composer, you know, you have to really guard that little personal perimeter that's around you. And you do need to be sometimes a little bit of an observer, whether it's of your own thoughts or whether it's of situations. To be able to guard your energy like that is really important. And meditation has been a life-changing practice for that reason.
You're exactly right that there needs to be this buffer around us that lets us be better observers. I love that word, observant, because I think it's a core quality that artists need to have. That's what we're doing, right? We're observing what's going on in this world and figuring out how to react to that and how to talk about it, how to live with it.
Yeah, how to process it. And, you know, so many people expect you to have some omniscient view of something. I mean, I'm not sure, you know, what your situation was with music related to COVID, but I think with a lot of composers, myself included, it was like this thing where somehow we were expected to be omniscient and comment on the thing that was happening to us, just like it was happening to everyone else. And they were like, tell us about this. Tell us how you feel. I'm like, I don't know. I'm just looking at the same world you're looking at. I don't know what's going on either. You know, but the thing I actually wanted to return to is that, you know, the thing about meditation is I say all this not as someone who is good at it. Like, I am so bad at meditation. It's just that I sit there and do it every day. And I feel it's really hard. If you're at the level where you've become a professional composer, I mean, chances are you're pretty good at composing and you know, have been quite good at composing for a long time. And so sometimes you just don't like to feel bad at a thing. And I realized that meditation is a chance for me to spend X amount of minutes every day reflecting on how bad I am at doing that thing. Deeply uncomfortable place for me to be. But I also realized that getting comfortable with that discomfort is part of the whole thing of meditation. And I also think, you know, then it helps me get comfortable with my discomfort with other things, because often the things that we maybe feel the most self-conscious about are things that if we're in the right mindset, it beckons us to work on those things more. And I know for a long time for me, I always felt very self-conscious about my harmonic language and my harmony. And I thought, I feel like I don't really understand harmony the way I understand melody. And over the years, I mean, I've gotten so many compliments specifically on my harmony. And I'm like, don't you know that I'm bad at this? And then I realized, like, no, I've spent so much time working on it that I actually have come up with something that feels a lot of people can relate to it, right? And a lot of people feel very moved by it. But it comes from that place where I feel self-conscious, and so I do a lot of work on it. And I think meditation allows you to lean into those places and actually work and understand what's there, as opposed to just shying away from those things.
Yeah, nicely put. I'd love to go back a little bit and talk a little bit more about ingenuity, because that's a really tricky thing and is something that I struggle with when I'm mentoring other composers about how do you learn how to be inventive within this art form? And I think the first step is knowing it inside out, right? Knowing what you can do and what's tricky and all that. But then I also wanted to start with a little bit of a story, because it's been on my mind since it just happened, actually. Yeah. I was at a concert where my multimedia work was performed, The Notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci, and it was with an orchestra that had been around for a while, you know, so they knew what they were doing, and they had two other pieces on the program, and I don't want to say exactly what they are, because then we'll be able to find out, you know, who this is. but one of the other pieces was by another contemporary composer, a man who's very well known in the choral world. And as I sat there and I listened to his piece, because his piece was first before mine, and I listened to it and I was like, wow, the orchestra sounds really great on this piece. And then in the same moment, I also realized it was because he wasn't asking anything new of them.
Right.
And then it got to my piece and they struggled a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's because I was asking the orchestra to do things that they weren't used to doing. And it was one of those instances where I wasn't able to work with the orchestra beforehand, which is always kind of a bummer. But I don't regret writing the music that way, knowing that it's harder to get inside and figure out. But I have a feeling that your experience with this type of thing is similar because of the way that you push musicians to go beyond their comfort zone and try something new. I just love to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things that I could say about that. And you know, what a great way to illustrate what that is, because I think when you're a really young composer, you know, when you're still a student, a lot of times you can't tell whether it's you or them, or whether the piece is non-idiomatic, or whether it's just taking people a moment to get their heads around it. And I think there's something really interesting to me. We think about premieres as, you know, the word premiere, even it's like, oh, it's this momentous occasion, stuff like that. Not that your piece was a premiere, but like maybe it was the first time the orchestra had engaged with it or something. And so we think of it as we build things up to the first performance. To me, I love the way that the tech world sees it as like beta or like version 1.0 or, you know, and it's always just like a work in progress. And once people have context and once people can kind of work out the kinks, things get better. And so one of the things that I've realized is, again, when you're a young composer, sometimes your work gets done once and then it never gets done again. So you think that whatever that performance was your work. And then, you know, it gets the next level where maybe you'll get a couple performances of something. Once you get to the point, you know, and I think you and I are both at this point where you have 10 performances, 50 performances of a work, you realize the work starts to change because the people who have performed it have started to talk to one another. And they've started to make this performance practice around your work that has kind of nothing to do with you, but is a way for performers to process your work to one another. And that is when I think things really start to change. And when you start to see things like a Beethoven sonata, right? It's not about Beethoven. It's about each person putting their own individual mark on something that already has a performance practice around it. And to me, that is when things start to codify in a certain way. I try to think about that in my work because, especially with a premier ensemble, but I mean, even more so with the ensemble that's making the first recording of the piece, I try to make sure that they have a really good sense of how to execute that piece. Because in a way, I think we give like way too much credit to the fact that someone can look at a bunch of dots and with no context, somehow create the piece that you want them to create. Like there's so much more that's necessary. And just because we can do it with music we've already heard doesn't mean that we can do it with music we haven't heard. And I mean, there's so many people are commissioning music these days at a rate that I don't know. I mean, I feel like it's unprecedented. I feel like there's so many opportunities for new music. And yet I don't think we really still have a sense about how to approach a piece you haven't heard before. And so a lot of times I do think for me, it's getting to that first recording, having the recording be out in the world and having that recording be really what my vision is. And then that becomes its own performance practice and then allows people to do what they want with it.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about this because I think it's easy to feel stuck once a piece is finished, you know, it's out in the world already, you know, and it's been recorded. So I guess I should probably just keep it that way, you know, right. And I don't think that's true either. I think of this art form as a very living thing. Mm-hmm. And in order to live, it needs, you know, lots of different performances of it. And that is how we figure out, because the only thing we really control as the composer is the score. And exactly. I feel like it takes numerous performances before I can look at the score and say, I believe this is the best version of the score to put out into the world.
Absolutely.
It's just a process that takes time. And I think that younger composers or composers that are just starting out might not feel comfortable doing that kind of work, but we right. do it.
Exactly. I mean, it also takes, like you said, it takes a number of performances. It takes some distance from the piece. It takes just some more context and perspective in order to even understand whether something needs to be changed or whether something really is okay the way it is and it's up to the performers to work it out. And I felt like when I was younger, I wanted to control things much more. Like I really wanted to have everything be, you know, perfectly notated exactly so there was no room for any confusion. I didn't necessarily know I could trust the players as much as I realize I can now. And so I think my process has actually gotten much more, the first thing that goes onto the page feels a little bit more sketchy, but is also a little bit more like a mock-up. And people are playing it, and then I can get information about what actually really works and what I need to add and what I can take away. And I think it is much more of a dynamic process now, because you have to build up that trust both in the performers and just in yourself and your own intuition and your fact, the fact that you'll know when you hear it what it needs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Definitely. Yeah. And a lot of times I want to hear different players do that same line or that same thing and see, did they all do it the same way, you know, without trying, without me talking about it?
Well, and also I think that when you start developing really long relationships with musicians who play different instruments and sing in different ways, you can also grow together and grow into a space that neither of you knew was possible. And I do think that comes out of relationship, which just comes out of trust. And so much of the music I've built, there are things that if you looked at it on the page, you would be like, there's no way that someone could get to that thinking of what's possible for this instrument. But it really comes from me sitting down with a player who is someone who's, you know, really close to me and being like, okay, now try this. Okay, now maybe try this. And then you just get into this place and you realize there's so much sound that still hasn't been explored yet. And the way that you can create something that both feels really organic and you know, natural for a player and feels so unusual to the listener is just by that kind of trial and error process and moving further into that trust with the player you're working with.
Yep. We have so much to learn from performers and to not be afraid to ask.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a big, you know, part of the questioning and curiosity. Being not afraid to ask the questions that you think are the stupid questions. I really think if I could have gone back and said, the things you wish you had told your younger self, it's like, don't be afraid to ask the stupid question or the question you think is stupid, because if you're really curious about it, it can lead you in such interesting ways.
I'd love to talk to you about Black Iris, because I found out recently that you had retitled the piece from its original title, #MeToo. And you made this statement that I'd like to read. Quote, "It guts me to my core to feel that years of trauma for so many women can be so easily deemed passé as soon as a hashtag stops trending. But I hope that the message is not lost." End quote. Can you talk about your decision to change the title of the piece?
Oh, I'm so glad we're talking about this. You know, you're really the first person that's engaged me on this, and that means a lot to me, first of all. You know, as artists, and especially as composers who are putting this new work into the world, you're always trying to gauge, like, how is this work going to, you know, both help me process what I'm feeling and also help kind of galvanize around these things that I care about. And I think the Me Too movement was maybe the one movement that I felt just such a deep personal connection to, because I mean, without going into too much detail, it's very hard to be a woman at this age in this field without having experienced some trauma. And I certainly have experienced my share of trauma. And when you experience that, especially, you know, it was so early in my life, you just have the sense of, I have to take this to the grave with me. There will be no time when I can ever bring this up again, and I just need to bury it. And so I made that decision when I was really young, and it affected so many things. It affected my relationships with people. It affected how honest I could be with myself. It affected my body image. It affected all these things. And then the Me Too movement happened, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is finally a chance for all of us who have just been completely locked down. We thought it was only us to actually begin to share these stories. And I felt both so, you know, excited by that prospect that we could actually contextualize one another's stories. And then also I really started to feel the outrage that had just been simmering in me for so long. And so the piece itself is about this this idea that we have to kind of, we have as if you're a woman who's kind of experienced this trauma, or honestly, if you're anyone who has experienced trauma, you have this vision of what you want to create, and yet you keep on getting thrown off track. And especially if you're a musician, sometimes it's the music itself that will bring up the trauma. So maybe there's a piece that you love, but then it starts to get associated with this really bad memory. And then every time this beautiful music comes back, it just brings up trauma for you. And I think in a way, that's why so many women end up leaving music, is because the source of their greatest joy is also the source of their greatest trauma. And so, you know, we don't talk about that enough, and I had really wanted to talk about it. So I asked Chicago Sinfonietta at that point, you know, could I just title the piece hashtag Me Too, because I knew they were putting it on an album, and I, you know, I didn't want to just be the person who just, you know, made them lose funding or whatever. I always try to be a team player, and they were super supportive, and I did it, and I was really proud of it at the time because it felt brave, and it felt like I was really taking a step out to be like, yeah, I'm among the group of people. Some people are making Facebook posts. This is my contribution to that movement, and I just want it to be lost in the sea of stories of that movement. It shouldn't be more special than anyone else's hashtag. I had wanted it to be a call to orchestras to kind of ask them, well, are you willing to program the work of a composer who, you know, was basically traumatized by the system that created her as a composer? And that was, you know, again, in 2017, that was a question that no one was asking. And now I realize it's polarized the other way, where people kind of use it as a political pawn. Like, look, she was abused. Like, no, let's play her piece. And I don't love that either, because that's not my entire identity. And it's like, you'll see, and I'm sure people have dug to be like, oh, who's the person who abused her? And the thing is, I mean, it was a teacher of mine, but it's someone who you will never find associated with me. Believe me, I've done so many internet searches and his name never comes up because he's not a famous composer. And the thing is that I hope his name never comes up. I hope it gets buried in the history of time. And I hope no one ever actually gives him any, I just hope that he never sees the light of day. To me, that would be the best possible thing. But in the end, you know, I realized the piece needed another title. And so I titled it Black Iris after the Georgia O'Keeffe painting, because I love Georgia O'Keeffe. Oh my goodness, her work is so inspirational to me. And also, you know, my parents used to love her, and we used to have these beautiful Georgia O'Keeffe greeting cards that my mom would send out to people sometimes. And so I just grew up seeing her work. And it's, if you look at the painting, if you Google the painting, you'll see that there's part of this iris that's white and there's part of this iris that's black. And you can see that, you know, there's this dark, something that's so beautiful also has this very, very dark underside. So that was what the final title has been.
Wow. Thank you for all of that. And there's just so much truth in all you said. And for so many of us, it is something that we want to bury and never talk about or never tell anybody about. And just in that time, realizing how widespread it was really eye-opening. And and then that shared guilt and trauma associated with that.
Right.
Just so much to unpack. Thank you for talking about it.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you for asking me, honestly. And it means a lot, because I feel like sometimes, and maybe you get this too, that a lot of times the reason I get asked about these things is because people want gossip, right? And I think, like, it's so hard to have these conversations where, you know, clearly you're talking to another person who also has skin in the game and who's also trying to unpack these things for herself. And so it feels very different to actually have an honest conversation about these things. So thank you for that. I appreciate it.
We'll listen to a brief excerpt of Black Iris now. And I encourage you all to listen to the full recording by the Chicago Sinfonietta on your preferred streaming platform. I'm a big fan of your piece, Tutorana. It's delightful and rhythmic and exciting. And I also love that you created a supplemental video to help people learn the music and learn the ideas. And just so you know, people who are listening to this, your YouTube channel is great and you should definitely subscribe. And I wish we talked about all that stuff more. I think, you know, influencers or, you know, a lot of people are not shy about asking people to subscribe, but right, for some reason, composers are. And so I just want to say, you know, subscribe to her YouTube channel and you can learn so much. You know, it's not just about listening to the recordings and performances, but it's also about why this music exists. How do you actually perform this? What is the composer's intent? And all of that is just so valid and useful. So thank you for putting so much time and energy into that, because
it is a
big deal to put that much energy into a YouTube channel.
Yes, I know. When I'm always like, oh, I could put more energy into this YouTube channel. I have a few things, and like you said, they've all been these practical things where I just know that people don't necessarily have the context they need to engage with the work, because we don't have that kind of training when we train as Western musicians. So, I mean, instead of just blaming people for not knowing things, why don't I just give them all the possible information that could be in my head, right? And then we're all on the same page.
Yeah. And the other thing that I loved about looking up Tutorana specifically is that you also arranged it for brass quintet.
Yes. I'm so glad you found that.
And it sounds fantastic for brass quintet. So all of you guys that are listening, you know, take a minute to listen to the original is the SSA, right?
Right, exactly.
And then go listen to the brass quintet version. There's a great recording video by Seraph Brass, and
yes,
it's fantastic. So please listen.
It's funny because between my manager and I, we call the version that is for brass quintet Tutorana, because, you know, toot like brass.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's very good.
Yes.
Thank you. My conversation with Rena was so rich, I realized I was running out of time to ask her all of my questions. So I finished up with a few quick ones that I knew I wanted to talk with her about.
I know it's hard to choose between pieces, but do you have a piece of music of which you are especially proud?
Yeah, it changes from time to time. I will say that I definitely had this one moment where, you know, I have this oratorio called This Love Between Us. And, you know, it's seven movements, takes seven different texts from different Indian religions or religions that are have a lot of following in India. And talks about the places where the religion says in its text about being good to one another, about treating each other with kindness, and it kind of juxtaposes those texts. And it was interesting because I was writing it in 2016 during the 2016 election. So you can imagine there were days where I was like, what is the purpose of this? What am I even doing? And I think sometimes it's those moments where you really don't know what the direction is, that you have to will yourself to find some direction, and it can actually kind of save you. And I do think that piece really saved me in many ways. But it sounds kind of morbid to say, but after I wrote that piece and after we had the tour, which was, it started at Lincoln Center and then we took it to different cities throughout India. And it was just an incredible, incredible experience. After I wrote that piece, I definitely had this thought that has never left me, which is just that, you know, like if I die tomorrow, the fact that I have written that piece and put that into the world, like I feel like I've done what I need to do, you know, and everything after that is like, you know, I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to continue to explore and write music. But that was the moment where I felt like if that was the last thing I left in the world, I would be fine with that.
Oh, I love that so much. That is just what an incredible feeling to have that. And and you're still young. You're younger than me. There's a lot of music left in there. And so that's just also really exciting.
Well, and it's really freeing too, because now I don't feel like, oh my God, I have to come up with this thing that's my, to me, I'm like, that was it. That was the thing that I was working my whole life towards, being able to say this thing. And now it's just fascinating to see what directions I can go in and explore without that same weight of like, you know, the way that it took Brahms 20 years to get to his first symphony because he was like living under the weight of Beethoven. And then once that was out, then he could do all these other things. You know, I felt a little bit like that, being out of the weight, out from under the weight of This Love Between Us has allowed me to just embrace new things in my style and be much more nimble and flexible and try things without feeling like I have this consequence or anything to prove.
I love that so much.
Yeah.
Okay. So one last one. Dream project. What would it be?
So what's really amazing is that I don't know how much to say about this because the dream project is happening. And basically, like if someone had asked me a few years ago, you know, what's your dream project? And to me, it would be to write a concerto for orchestra. And when I was in high school, I hand rewrote out the first movement of Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, like note for note, wrote it out with a pencil and paper so that I could actually learn how the piece worked. And since that time, since I was in my teens, that Bartok Concerto for Orchestra has just been, to me, like the holy grail of all music in the world. And so, you know, from that time, I was like, oh, I want to write a concerto for orchestra. And lately, two amazing, amazing orchestras that unfortunately I'm not at liberty to say who they are yet, but I'm sure we'll find out soon enough. Two amazing orchestras co-commissioned this concerto for orchestra. So it is happening in, I think, the 25-26 season. We're just kind of firming up when that's all going to be. But it'll be incredible because a concerto for orchestra is essentially mini concertos for the principal players of those orchestras. And getting to work with them is just going to be just the joy of my life. So I'm gearing up for that and I'm looking forward to it. And I'm trying to basically clear out my schedule as much as I can so that, you know, back to your point about curiosity and asking questions, I actually get to sit down with these players and get to know a lot about their style. So it's almost like I really am writing mini concerti for each one of them.
Oh, that's so great. Well, I love asking that question because so many times I feel like putting a name or just voicing what that dream is can help push it into existence.
Right.
And I think that we, maybe even especially as women, are less likely to share what those dreams are.
Right.
And you know what's great about this is you're doing this dream right now and you'll have another one and you're going to do that one too.
The other thing I'll also say, you know, extra musical dreams too. A lot of the stuff that I'm building right now to build this pathway for Indian and Western classical music to come together in a meaningful way. I mean, the things that feel like an absolute dream come true to me is when I see, you know, a kid who's maybe a teenager or maybe in their 20s or even younger than that, and they've been trained in Indian classical music, but they go to a school where they only teach Western classical music. And the kid, you can see in their mind is like, okay, I have trained so deeply in this style of music, and why can I not play in an orchestra? Why can I not do this? And they can't quite figure out. They're like, is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with my values? And so my happiest places and my absolute dream in this world is to have those moments, of which I've luckily, you know, I've had many, where people have said, I didn't know, you know, teachers come to me and they're like, I don't know what to do with the student. They're so talented, but they don't study Western classical music. And I'm like, I have the piece for you. I have the rep. And then the student actually gets to show their culture to their own class and they get valued in a really different way. So to me, continuing to have those experiences and continuing to bring the cultures closer together so that performers from both traditions can find ways to value one another because there's a platform for that. I mean, to me, if again, if that's what I leave in the world as far as like relation between these cultures, that would be amazing.
That's just also wonderful. Rena, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. And I hope we get to meet again in person and actually be able to sit down and share a meal or a drink. And yeah, because I highly respect everything that you're doing and look up to you most definitely. And thank you for thank you for inspiring all of us.
Aw, thank you. Thank you so much, Jocelyn. So wonderful to talk to you.
Finding one's truth can take years. The process forces us to get quiet and still and lean into our instincts. No one can really show you how. Trust yourself and stay open to the possibilities. Compose Like a Girl was produced by Justin Schell, Laura Kreider, and me, Jocelyn Hagen, with special help from fellow composers Erica Malpass and Addie Struckman. The Compose Like a Girl theme music was composed by cellist Cicely Parnas. Thank you all for helping me with this vision. Thanks also to Sedil Records for their permission to use their recordings on today's episode. You can learn more about Rena Esmail and her music at renaesmail.com and by following her on social media. Check out the links in our show notes, visit jocelynhagen.com/compose-like-a-girl, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram to listen to the music we talked about today, learn more about the Compose Like a Girl initiative, and check out past episodes. You can also find choral programming ideas by checking out the Compose Like a Girl choral series through Graphite Publishing. To ensure that we can keep bringing these conversations to you, please consider joining our Compose Like a Girl Patreon page and giving what you can. And you can subscribe to the Compose Like a Girl podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're so moved, rate us on Apple Podcasts and share it with a few friends who you think will find inspiration. Until next time, trust your instincts. Be brave and unapologetic for your talents. Thanks for listening.